I'm Mike Solomon. I work at YouTube in the database infrastructure group, and I've done this for about off and on for about the last 7 years. And for the last year and a half, we've been working on this this project, which we've open sourced piecemeal, bit at a time. So quick show of hands, how many people are more interested in the MySQL part, and how many people are more interested? So MySQL part, raise your hands. Go part, raise your hands. Okay, so I'll so what I'll do is I'll sort of rush through the MySQL bit to sort of set up like what we're building and why, and then Sugu will go into some of the specifics of Go and how that's worked out for us. And we'll go kind of quickly and leave plenty of time for questions, which I think will probably be the most interesting way to go. So briefly, like what is this? What is the project about? So over the last few years, we've had to deal with scaling up a MySQL cluster and sharded, of course. And we have you have a lot of scripts that are homegrown to manage these things. We have recipes for dealing with a lot of different situations. But they lack a certain formality. So making changes or instancing new copies of the database are all kind of a pain. And what we wanted to do was basically learn from all those lessons, look at all that software, and distill it down to the simplest way to really manage a sharded MySQL instance. So our strategy has basically been to take the components that work and automate everything around it, using basic distributed systems principles, storing things in reliable file systems and lots of retries, lots of checking, et cetera. So I'll go over a little bit about our implementation strategy, and then I'll talk about what we have built, what we have deployed, what's available open source. So anything that I talk about in the first part is just sort of a sketch of where we want to go, and then we'll sort of tell you what's available, no sort of bait and switch. And obviously, we'll talk about the Go experience, and then, as I said, plenty of time for questions. So to give you kind of an idea of where we're going, I guess it's easier to tell you where we want to be. We like MySQL. We like a lot of parts about it. The performance is predictable. It has a lot of well-known quirks, but those are all fairly forgivable and easy to work around. So the major problem with MySQL is that once you get to a certain point, you're spending a lot of time managing the hardware and how many instances you have. And so we really want to automate that that chunk. We want to take every action that's complicated or error-prone and make the distributed system sort of heal itself. And we want to do this without a lot of magic, because there are going to be failure scenarios we've never seen, and we want to be able to leave a trail of breadcrumbs and some manholes to get in there to say, here's what happened, here's how we can fix it. We also want to increase the overall efficiency of the MySQL system. Right now, we have a lot of, if you have a lot of connections to MySQL, each one of those is a thread stack. The thread stack is expensive. Running tens of thousands of connections is not really viable. We can do that in our front-end server and actually save a lot of resources on MySQL. So instead of a lot of wasted memory for sort areas and thread stacks, we do all the queuing externally. And that benefits our memory usage, and it also smooths out the throughput actually going into MySQL and reduces the internal contention in the database engine. The other thing we want is external replication. MySQL is great for a lot of things, but it's not good for everything. So if we can get the data out in near real time with eventual consistency, that's a really powerful way to move the data into an alternate system for dealing with, say, either full-text search or sort of any sort of offline analysis you want to do, and just keeping it up to date cheaply. So when we're talking about managing MySQL, there are common themes about the events that you have to do. The most common one is the most common one that causes pain is reparenting when a master fails. So you have an entire replication hierarchy. When the master goes down, you have to take stock of where the slaves are, move them around, and you have to find the exact right replication position to restart everything at. And it's not particularly complicated, but it is error-prone when you do it by hand, and even a lot of scripts are not good at recovering or communicating to other shards or instances what's going on. So this is sort of like the most basic element we want to handle, because once you have, once reparenting and changing your master is essentially trivial, all these other actions become available to you. So online schema apply usually takes a long time. But if you can do all of your schema applies in the background and just fail in the master gracefully when everything's done, then you have a way of essentially doing downtimeless schema roles in almost every situation. The other sort of holy grail is auto sharding, where basically we want to deal with expanding primary key ranges, and we want to be able to partition that and add new hardware. And we don't want to have we want you to be able to expand and contract that relatively easily. And of course, we also want you to do this without any downtime. So the basic recipe is always to do this via replication, then fail something as the new master and upgrade your addressing system to reflect this change. So to sort of do this without too much trouble, we've had to make a lot of assumptions in terms of, well, not a lot, some assumptions and constraints about how we're going to deal with this. So in terms of the basic unit, we call them key spaces. And all the key space is just a collection of tables that share the leading edge of a primary key. We call it, naturally, the key space ID. And so this is how the shards are defined, and they're range-based, so that we can cheaply keep the map in memory. So the process of finding a shard is simply just, binary search of a set of ranges. We originally implemented this with the constraint on the primary key, the leading edge of the primary key, and then very recently we actually started to relax that, because there are times where it's actually not helpful in our system to have that primary key, and for the rebuild actions, you can actually do it offline as long as you have the key space ID tagging every row. So essentially, we use this key space ID on every we put a 64-bit int on every row in our system that helps you migrate the data between shards. The other thing we've assumed is that we want a shards by replicas structure. So we want shards for capacity and replicas for durability. And that keeps the efficiency relatively high. We need a certain number of replicas minimal for N plus 2, and then you may need some additional replicas for, we do some sort of use case based replicas. So for instance, if we want to partition OLTP load from like offline analysis, we'll have a special replica set that has these horrific queries that would otherwise bottleneck an OLTP load. The other thing we assume is that right now we assume that there are no cross-shard transactions, which seems like a huge cheat, but in our experience, it actually isn't all that necessary. So we have consistency within every key space ID, but we do not. But if you have two different key space IDs involved in a transaction, you just have to order them yourselves and hope all goes well. It's not that we can't add it, it's that we just didn't, at the time, we haven't needed it. And I should also add, obviously, that this is all based on eventual consistency. We don't have real-time synchronous replication. It's all based on the underlying MySQL replication stream. So I stole this slide from another talk I give internally at YouTube about how to build good distributed systems. But basically, we want to keep things as simple as possible. We want things to be automated. We want things to be reliable. But in general, the more simple it is, the better it is from the maintenance perspective and also from production debugging. That sort of informs how we actually write the software, too. MySQL, I don't know if anyone has actually looked into the MySQL code base and tried to make any changes, but it is not straightforward. And even if you, just when you think you know what you're doing, that's when you really start getting into trouble. And a lot of these conventions are not sort of obvious unless you've been working on MySQL for years and years, which we have not. So you also have to be a relatively good C++ programmer, which I am not. So The other thing is that MySQL is very reliable. The amount of data corruption we've seen over the last 7 years has always been tracked down to faulty hardware. So in general, I pretty much believe that MySQL doesn't corrupt data, except in the case of, you know, by hands, by deft hands that you know, mess up the replication position. Otherwise, in a stable state, it's fine. Putting our code into MySQL has always gone kind of badly, and if you segfault that process, you have a lot of other issues. So in the spirit of doing minimal changes, we've gotten it down to basically two patches we need for MySQL that are reliable and under about 25 lines each, which has not been easy, but I think it's been for the better. So instead of putting all this stuff in MySQL, we rely on an external query shaper, and this is basically a proxy for every single query that we send to MySQL. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. I think Sugal will give some details about how it's implemented and what its total capabilities are. This is the component that currently serves all of YouTube's traffic. And then, as I said, we want to do a lot of automated management. And so we have a component called we divide the table up into tablets. Each tablet has the same schema. Each tablet within a shard has the same schema, and each key space has the same schema across every shard. So, that's not entirely true. You can skew while you're doing an apply, but in general, we think of it as hopefully consistent. So the tablet manager is a small agent that lives on every MySQL, on every box running MySQL, and I'll give a diagram in a bit that should help clear this up, or hopefully, presuming everyone is 2020. And the tablet manager processes these actions and informs the query server about whether it can serve the query or not, or whether it needs to bounce around and look for data during a reshard process. It does all the coordination. The coordination data is actually kept in ZooKeeper. So how many people are familiar with ZooKeeper? Pretty good. So for those who are not, ZooKeeper is it's a component from Hadoop. It is the best way to think about it is a highly reliable notifying file system. So that is the spirit in which we use it. And I think I'll have a slide that'll detail a little of this more of this a little bit later. So I'll start with an overview of what the cluster ends up looking like. So we use these ZooKeeper instances. We keep one global cell across all of our data centers. And the more distance between the members of the nodes, the longer it takes to write. So we treat this as a precious resource. But if you have to do something that requires global coordination, this is pretty much the only way to go. So we try to keep that, like I said, absolutely minimal, and have everything else happen in the local ZooKeeper cells, which are specific to every data center. And so the ZooKeeper contains all the canonical data about the shard maps and what the state of every tablet is. And we export some of that data to DNS so we can quickly SSH in and out of servers or find things that way. And we also have a proxy service in front of ZooKeeper. So the ZooKeeper connection is actually quite costly to start up. And in fact, a series of misbehaving clients can actually take down a ZooKeeper cluster and prevent it from maintaining its internal quorum just by connecting really, really often. Every connection turns out to be a quorum write. So we have this very lightweight open connection cache for ZooKeeper. And so our client talks to this connection cache and gets all of its addressing data directly out of there. And so you can see the structure of the tablet is basically, it has one component, the query manager, which, like I said, Sugal will talk a little bit more about, and then the tablet manager, which is this agent that performs background tasks and cleanup and schema migrations and reparenting. All that stuff happens through there. We call the client the smart client because it's shard aware. So you can tag a query and it will find out where its shard is. You can tag its whether it's a read or a write, and do some smart routing. You can tag it for offline analysis versus like an online query. And all that, all those addresses are broadcast through ZooKeeper. Sorry, not broadcast. We read them out of ZooKeeper. VTCTL is our control console. It's a command line interface to all of the functionality of moving a shard or reinstancing, cloning, taking a snapshot. And it's really the only component that has to tie together the global and local zookeepers. So the only time you need the global zookeeper to be up is when you are making a change to the replication graph. Everything else you can live with zookeeper, and in fact you can live without zookeeper and operate in a stale state for some amount of time. I don't know exactly, the less time the better, but it will work. So this is more or less what I was saying. We sparing use of global for obvious reasons. ZKOCC is really just an insulation layer. The Zookeeper protocol, the Atomic Broadcast Protocol, is very, very complicated. So complicated that it can only be explained by the code which implements it, which is probably not a great situation, but it is what it is. And so there is one implementation in Java and one in C. The protocol is, like I said, very complicated, and the startup is costly. So by proxying all these things, we get a lot of insulation from momentary losses of quorum when, you know, if there's a fiber cut in the global cell and transactions are taking a very, very long time, we can read data that is most likely up to date very quickly without halting all the clients. So Zookeeper is also fail stop. So if the quorum is broken, you can't read or write because it's trying to guarantee that your reads are consistent. Since we don't particularly mind stale data, that's why we break that assumption here. So I hope you can see this. It actually looks pretty big and sharp to me. But the overall structure of a tablet node has MySQL and Memcache on the bottom, and then on top we have the VT tablet process, which is written in Go, and it has three major subcomponents. The tablet manager is the part I've been speaking about most. The query manager has its own full SQL parser, an analyzer, query rewriter, and it can actually has its own execute engine, and this lets us maintain a row-oriented cache that's consistent. So if a hot query comes in, we can actually look aside into a row-oriented cache instead of a block-oriented cache. And the efficiency of this is, depending on your data layout, and in our particular data layout, it's hugely beneficial. The amount of data we get for a much smaller footprint in memory is quite pronounced. And then obviously we have different connection pools for transactions versus consistent reads. And we also have this feature called the update stream, and the update stream basically turns the binary log into a reliable queue, and this is what I was talking about, external replication. So you can subscribe to notifications on a table, and you'll receive every primary key that's changed over time. For various historical reasons, we are sort of locked into statement-based replication. This would be a lot simpler in row-based, but. All right, so VTTablet implements a full query service, and right now every SQL query at YouTube goes through this query service. And we recently added, for a long time we said, okay, these are OLTP loads, no one should ever need more than 10,000 rows to render a single web page. That turns out to not be true, which is surprising. So we had to implement streaming to allow you to stream larger result sets. That recently went out, and it's for those rare cases where you need hundreds of thousands or more rows for a single page, it helps. It also helps us if we want to stream the entire database off into another VTTablet instance. Tablet management data, like I said, stored directly in Zookeeper. Update stream kind of went over all this already. So I'll just briefly talk about the action system and how that works in Zookeeper. So every tablet is represented by a node in Zookeeper, and every node has an action queue associated with it also in Zookeeper. And these are just simple things that look like files. And so when you want to take some action, for instance, like I want to make the master read only and put it in read only mode. If something is wrong, I need to take a look at it. I need to stop all writes. So you tell VTCTL that you want to set this master to read only. And you know, normally you would just log into MySQL, set it to read only, and various things would break. In this case, the VTCTL says, okay, I'm going from read write to read only. I will update the tablet state if I can make the change, and then I will inform the clients that this is the case, and they can present a more graceful error message or try and re-resolve their to see if there's been a new master that's been elected. The reason that we reliably queue these is because it makes debugging a lot simpler. If something goes wrong in the middle, the action has like a paper trail of where it was when it failed, and you can more or less get in there and unstick the system as it blocks. Most actions are actually will actually stop the queue right now, just because if we don't have an automated recovery strategy, we assume it's something we've never seen, so we just leave it there. And the system will either temporarily route around it or somebody will have to get paged and fix it. The other thing we do is we want to be able to update the software on VT Tablet very quickly. So VT Tablet is more or less has fairly minimal state. So restarting a new one under full load is more or less a non-event. So the thing is, though, while you have some action going on, that would seem to be not interruptible, or at least not a good idea to not interrupt. So what we do is every action is forked off as a separate process, and that process uses the Zookeeper cluster and some additional data to allow a tablet server to restart and then re-resume an action without actually breaking the process. And the term we use for all this is just manholes. In the version one of the system, it was a good prototype, but the guy we share an office with said, it's great, you have like this little window, but what you need is a manhole, because you need to actually get in there and be able to fix all these parts. And so the way that we essentially get manholes is by, we've made the system feel very much like Unix. Like all these parts are, we have a little command line tool to look at the state of the file system that's distributed. We have a little tool that lets you enqueue actions. And you can just take apart things and look, it's very easy to reassemble all these things. So all the things you know about debugging a regular system apply more or less to our now distributed system. Let's see, update stream I more or less mentioned. It's derived from the bin log, but we need to actually, when you have multi-statement, when we have complex updates, you need to tell every primary key. So the query server actually injects these comments that let us reconstitute exactly what changed from every statement. See, so I guess I'll let you.
Okay.
All right.
All right. So I'm going to cover this stuff a little quickly so that we can talk more about Go. So the query server part of this project was launched sometime last year. So it's been serving all of YouTube's traffic for well over a year now. And the VT tablet is basically additions to this, all the other features that Mike talked about. So this part has been quite stable. So I'll quickly go over this. If you have any questions later, I can talk more in more detail about what this does. So at a high end, it's basically sits in front of MySQL and serves all the traffic that goes to it. And the main reason why we launched it early was because MySQL was running out of steam. It couldn't handle the growing number of connections that we were having, and this came in and helped us pool all those connections. And we could have done it very simply without by just getting all the connections and then just sending the query as is, but we thought we'll benefit a lot by actually writing a parser, an SQL parser that actually understands the query, because we can do more interesting things with it once we understand what the request is, so which is what the query server does. In the beginning, a lot of people were questioning what value does this add if all it does is take the data and give it to the app. But of course, there are reasons why it did benefit, which is why it's still running. Now it's been very steady, and it's served traffic for a long time. It has all the necessary tools for you to actually use it in a production environment. It's a mature product. Some of the cool things that it does is very often we call about this F5 problem is when a page doesn't load because a request takes too long, people keep hitting refresh. And those actually can kill the database server because a large number of expensive queries can slam the database. What this query server does is if one query is already running and another identical one comes in, it does not send that query to the database. It just waits for the results of the first one and then send the same results back to the server. So that has saved us quite a few times. And sometimes there are pathological cases where one certain user has like 200,000 videos and things like that. And those grow organically, and you initially think that, oh, who would ever have more than 500 videos? That's not true. So what VT OCC does is set some hard limits on how many rows can be returned, and if you exceed that limit, it tells you, and then you can go and rewrite your query to be more efficient. And because it has basically an SQL parser, we've been able to add basically all these kinds of bells and whistles that allow us to prevent the database from falling over due to a not well-behaving client. Rocache actually deserves its own slide because of what we think it can achieve. MySQL traditionally caches pages, and that is not necessarily efficient for random access patterns. It's very good if you're scanning a table, if you're doing data warehousing kind of queries, but if you're just fetching one row at a time from different parts of a table, it is very, very inefficient. And what we decided to do was actually if it is a single row query, then we don't send it to MySQL. We cache that in a separate row cache and then get it from there. If there is a query that requires a subquery, then we issue the subquery separately and then first look it up on the row cache. And then only what does not get it, what cannot be hit from the memcache, then we send it to MySQL and then consolidate the results and send them back to the client. Unfortunately, we haven't launched this live yet, but our benchmarks have been very, very encouraging. Depending on the query pattern, depending on how much random access you have, we have seen that you could get anywhere between 5 to 10x throughput from a single MySQL instance. Like I tested this on a box that was able to do about 5 to 7,000 QPS, and with row cache enabled, I was able to get about 35 to 40,000 QPS just on the same hardware without making any major changes. We'll probably announce more results once we actually launch this live, but it's looking very promising right now. And I can talk in more detail about how we keep the cache consistent. There's a lot of magic that goes behind this. And this is something that we talked about, so I'll skip. It's basically what are the stuff that we haven't done yet that is coming up. Going to quickly switch over to Go. We're going to talk about a little bit about the highlights and the lowlights of having chosen Go to implement this project, and also a little bit about the deployment. So in terms of the main reason, the main benefit that we have seen from Go is general productivity. In terms of expressibility, Go falls between C and Python. Actually, closer to Python, I would say. There's another slide that covers why it is like that. It compiles very fast, like our VT tablet. VT OCC compiles in about 1.5 to 2 seconds, I think, the last time I timed it. Maybe 3 seconds. That's how long it takes to build the entire binary. It takes longer?
No, it takes 30 seconds to compile 30,000 lines.
Oh, it's much faster, definitely. Are you sure?
To compile, oh, to compile all four tools, all four times.
Who cares? Yes. For me, it builds in 3 seconds. For him, it builds in 30 seconds. And the libraries that come with Go are very well thought out and very useful. We have used most of the libraries, and they have actually saved us a lot of time. Here's some numbers. It's so expressive that I had to talk about how many lines it took for me to write some things. I had to write a log file interface where we don't want log files to just clog up our system. So I wrote a log file interface that would make sure that log files don't exceed certain size, and they rotate every day or every hour, depending on how much traffic that goes. And it has to limit the number of files, the maximum number of log files that we keep in the system. 105 lines. I don't think you can do that with C++. Maybe Python, but not C++ or C. I wrote a connection pooler. This is a very sophisticated connection pooler that will automatically open a new connection when an existing connection goes bad. It'll make sure that any new incoming requests wait until another connection is come in. It's a standard connection pooler, just 200 lines. A Memcache client, 250 lines. I just looked up libmemcached. It has like thousands of lines of code. Just to open a connection, that was like 800 lines. So that's how expressive Go is. And the reason is because of the language features. They are well thought out language features, and they help you compose things in a much more elegant way than a traditional language that C++ does. Especially the interfaces, they allow you to formalize when you write a library, you can formalize what contract you have with the outside world, and it's very it matches very well about how you think in terms of design, design and how you compose things. Like for example, the log file thing that I talked about is basically confirms to a file interface, which means that I can use that to it can be read as a file, which means that you can use it for network I/O, you can use it for file I/O, you can use it for streaming something somewhere else. So wherever somebody wants to write something, you can just use this, and there is no need to do any special magic for composing things. And Go also has good concurrency support. Those Go routines are really lightweight and cheap, so you don't have to worry about managing threads because the runtime manages threads for you in the background, so you can launch like 10,000 Go routines if you feel the need for it. They run in a limited number of threads, and Go manages the pools. Defers and closures are actually a convenience that have also paid us well. It makes the code like very read very nicely. We also benefited from CGo, which is basically which means that it allows us to call into C without too much hassle. You import C like a package and just use the C types as if they were native types. Channels, I don't know how many of you have heard about Go channels. They are good, but they have limited use. We haven't benefited as much from channels as we would have liked to. It's because their use cases are somewhat limited. As soon as something communication becomes more complex than send and receive, where the recipient has to send back an error, or if there are multiple senders or multiple recipients, it gets slightly more complicated than the simple use case. But nevertheless, they are very good, especially the select on the channel is really, really useful. I'm skimming over this, so if you have any questions later, you can ask us. Not everything has been smooth. There are some rough edges to Go. One thing is strings in Go are immutable, and byte arrays are mutable. But then it is very hard to choose when to use what, and you always find yourself having a byte array and having to send a string somewhere, and that requires a copy. And sometimes you have a string, and then somebody expects a byte array. So it does cause some impedance mismatch in APIs. We have hacked up a few workarounds that we can talk about. There are ways to work around this problem. Error handling has also been a major cause of discussion in our group. We have never been able to agree on what is the right way to handle errors. There are some parts that are really good, some parts that are not very elegant. Garbage collector actually was a big problem for a long time in the early days, but they recently made an improvement, a parallel garbage collector that works really, really well. The only time you would probably find a problem is if you allocate huge amounts of memory. If you basically don't do caching using Go, use like memcache is would be our advice. Like you can probably go up to like 15, 16 gigs, and you won't see much of performance degradation with Go. But if you go beyond that, you'll start to see some slowdown. So it's good. So to be on the safer side, we are just using memcache for caching stuff. And the scheduler also can be improved, and it's actually being actively worked on as we speak. And once those things are in, you can really do some pretty serious QPS with Go. Mike will talk about the pitfalls. You have very little time, though.
Oh, sorry. So not everything with Go has been rosy. How many people have actually programmed in Go? Okay, so this problem has bit us a number of times. Basically, the interfaces are exactly how an interface is implemented is relevant, and they don't talk about that much. And so in this case, it looks like your error should be nil, but it's not, because there's a compiler trick where nil in an interface context is actually nil type and nil value, and this return is actually type of my a pointer to my error, and the pointer value is nil, and so nil is not nil in this case, and this it ends up biting everybody three to four times before you figure it out. So that's definitely something that's a little nasty. Same thing with range variables. You're iterating over the URLs, and you want to concurrent, like, you know, this is obviously stupid, but if you were concurrently trying to fetch them, the answer how many URLs get printed, I don't know, because it depends. It's not deterministic, because the URL value here is actually the same thing, and it's getting copied, into it's getting referenced in the closure. So you actually have to pass in range variables. If the variable had been defined in the for scope, it would have been safe. So this is sort of a rough edge, and they know about it, but they can't change the language spec at this point. So I'll talk real briefly about deploying. Go is statically linked until you use cGo. So basically, the minute we have a dependency on the MySQL libraries or Zookeeper, those libraries have to be included. This is actually very handy for production debugging, because you can actually change the Go runtime anywhere and then statically link up and run whatever you compiled. That's been very handy for finding bugs on prod that are fairly subtle. It has an integrated web server that you can pull memory and CPU profiling data from. We export a lot of variables about the health of the system as HTTP, as JSON. The other thing is that SIGABORT. SIGABORT tells you exactly where the state of every Go routine stack, which is really helpful if something's just completely wedged. So the other thing is that for a concurrent language, it's relatively strace friendly. There's not a lot of superfluous communication. So if your program is relatively simple, then your strace will still be fairly simple, which is handy if you're trying to figure out what went horribly, horribly wrong. So I spend some non-trivial amount of time debugging this in production when there's something wrong. So all of these things are noticeably better than say Java. Trying to strace a Java process and see what's going on, for instance, like Zookeeper, it is almost completely pointless. But here you can kind of figure out what's going on. New committers, our team actually, it used to be just me and Sugu, but we have expanded by over 100%, so that's good. We're obviously hiring, but let's take questions. So I'm sorry we didn't go as fast as we thought we would.
No questions.
All right.
Yeah. There's one.
Hmm. Some of the changes that you're talking about change the actual queries and semantics that are used by the developers with the database. They can't use, or it's not as efficient to use what they would normally think of with some MySQL queries and whatnot. Did you see any of that, or was there any pushback on that? How did that work?
So most of the rewrites that we do, real-time rewrites, are transparent to the user. So in general, a couple of times we've had to restrict things, and we'll send back. We'll run an analysis on what we saw yesterday and say, we think out of the 5,000 odd plans we found, like 3 or 4 are problematic. We'll contact them independently. But no, in general, people are pretty supportive, and they know that we're working in their best interest, even if. Screwy things like bind variables in your select clause, rather than your where clause. You implemented that anyway. He blew it up himself. So I mean, we have to every time we ratchet down or ratchet up the tightness, we've had pretty good support.
Yeah, rewrites are semantically equivalent.
Yeah, we don't change the semantic. Yeah.
Sometimes
the answer.
We prevent things. We start returning errors, and then they fix it.
Are you guys using stock MySQL 5.5 or something like that? Cluster changes or what?
We are using 5.163.3. And it is the community build module, like I said, a few very small patches. We are actually going to try, we're trying to upgrade to, we're trying to apply some of the Google patches to our own build. We actually don't use the Google build internally. We have our own clusters, so.
Have you guys looked at 5.6 yet at all? With GTIDs?
What was the last part?
With GTIDs.
What's GTIDs?
Global transaction identifiers.
Yes. So we're actually applying the global transaction identifier to the 5.1 tree. So we have that patch has been internal and stable at Google for a long time, and that's the road we're going. That will help recovery quite a bit.
I would imagine. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hi, Ken Scar from VMware. Can you talk about how your debugging experience have been? Like, for example, if you have a large number of code routines, to actually tracing and following and debugging code for your components.
Sure. We have at any given time in a production system, I think the number of go routines is probably in the tens of thousands. We haven't had to interactively debug any of that. It is a massively concurrent thing, but the concurrency primitives are good, and the synchronization package is very clear about what guarantees you have, and the memory model is quite simple. Most of the time, if we have a concurrency bug or we see an occasional panic, so a panic will give you a full stack trace of every single Go routine that was in flight. That can turn out to be several megabytes. And usually from that trace, it involves just thinking very hard about how that happened and then releasing a patch and hoping we never see it again.
I think specifically, if you come from a programming model where you have used threads, where things like thread IDs are very exposed to you, with Go routine, you have very little visibility to do inspection, by adding code to your code to do debugging.
Yes. So Go routines, the idea of the Go routine is not easily exposed. That hasn't limited us in any way. I think that in general, the way that the Go programming model encourages you to work is very independent of where your stuff runs. Now, you do have to care about what thread you're scheduled on occasionally, but only when you're interfacing with C code that expects global variables to be set up thread-specific globals to be set up in a particular way. So if you have code that has
Go routines have IDs. It shows up in the stack trace.
Right, it shows in the stack trace, but it's not easily identifiable.
You cannot view it while it's running. Yes. But there was one bug where it happened only once when there was a very tough deadlock to debug. And what we did was we started the server, issued a panic, caused it to crash, and then we had the entire stack of each coroutine where it was. And then when you looked at where who's holding the logs and who's waiting for it, it kind of became obvious what needed to be fixed.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
We didn't know back then that you could I think SigAbort was added after that, but SigAbort essentially does this. We have an embedded web server that lets us crash the server when we want or grab little bits of data in and out of it.
Another question. You guys haven't tried to use any of the SSL support in Go, like the standard library?
We have not. No, we have not used the SSL support.
Good. We have Sazzle.
Yeah, we have Sazzle, but not SSL. So we've messed with the crypto package, seems pretty good, but I don't know about SSL. Any other questions? All right. Thanks, guys.